Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby. My special guest today is Neil Carberry. Neil's the CEO of the Recruitment and Employment Confederation. Prior to joining the REC, Neil was the managing director at the Confederation of British Industry, leading the CBI's work on the labor market, skills, energy, and infrastructure. Neil actually started his career in recruitment with an exec search firm called Fraser Watson in 1999, and then went on to do a post-grad in HR at London School of Economics before joining the CBI. Welcome, Neil. Thanks for doing this.
Hi, Mark. Delighted to join you.
All right. So we're actually recording late December, but by the time this goes out, it's going to be the new year. So happy new year.
Well, happy new year to you. And let's hope it's a slightly better one than 2020 proved to be.
Never before have I been so happy to start a new year, I can tell you.
Well, the standard joke I make with people is that there are 12 months in 2020, January, February, March, right. And that's definitely how it's felt.
Absolutely. So listen, everyone in the UK knows the REC, but for our international audience, can you briefly explain what the Recruitment and Employment Confederation does?
So the REC is the UK's professional and industry body for recruitment firms, everything from MSP providers to local high street firms, generalists, sector specialists, all scales and sizes. About 3,300 companies in membership and about 10,000 individuals working with us through our REC professional scheme. And for those who are working internationally, you know, if you're in the US, you'll know the American Staffing Association. If you're in Australia, New Zealand, you'll know the RCSA. Very much equivalent organisations. And actually, we work very closely together under the auspices of the World Employment Confederation, of which I'm a board member.
All right. Awesome. That's a massive percentage of the industry that's part of the REC. I mean, 10,000 individual members and over 3,000 companies. It's quite incredible. I think that gives you quite a unique vantage point for understanding what's really going on in our industry and what the future looks like for recruiters. So I'm hoping that you're going to have a glimmer of good news for us today.
Well, let's see what we can do. You're right. The REC covers about 80% of the turnover in the UK industry in membership, and that gives us a very privileged insight into what's going on, both to support the industry in terms of thinking about our plans ahead, but also to represent the industry outside recruitment and staffing, which I think is a really important role we play.
Wow. So I didn't realize that the REC membership represents 80% of all the revenue generated by the recruitment industry in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Okay. So listen, let's just talk generally about where are we now? And then what's next for the recruitment industry? Like, can you just give us some context here in terms of what you've seen over 2020 and all the conversations and the research that you guys are doing? And then what are you sort of forecasting is going to happen next?
So, 2019 was not a stellar year for the industry. It was tough in all sorts of ways, but, you know, people were making good progress. Actually, in many ways, 2020 started looking like a better year. Lots and lots of recruiters I talked to had really good Januaries and Februaries. If you think back then to then, we were coming out of a long period of political instability in the UK, and we seem to be on a clearer path. There was a lot of activity going on. Then you got to the pandemic. When the pandemic hit, I think it's fair to say that weekend of the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th of March, you know, whiteboards across the industry just emptied. They emptied the perm jobs, and they dropped significantly in terms of temp placements. If you ask me anecdotally what I think happened in late March, I think we lost about 40% of temp turnover and maybe more like 80% of immediate perm work. Now, the bounce back from that started to happen almost immediately. And of course, temp is much more real time because companies are billing as people are working, whereas there's a longer pull through for permanent work. But we just published at the end of December, our industry trends survey. And that stacks up this story that 2020 was a year that saw the industry take quite a significant hit in turnover terms. And a lot of the struggle for businesses was to maximize that turnover, but also to find the ways to break even through the year in how they were managing their own business and the areas they were focusing on. And I think by and large, most recruiters I talk to in the UK would say that they achieved that goal. You know, a phrase I hear a lot is, if you'd offered me where I am now back in May, I'd have taken it. And partially that's, you know, good husbandry of the organizations they're running by recruitment leaders. And partially it is that the UK labor market has bounced back. I think temp started to come back quite quickly, even before the full lockdown was eased. So thinking about June, perm took a bit longer, maybe coming back more robustly in July. And all of our surveys have shown is vacancy numbers. If you look at one metric, posting to jobs boards in the first week of December, postings reached the level they were at the beginning of March. So fully recovered. Clearly a very different mix between sectors, and it has been a story of different sectors this year. If you're supplying workers into warehouses, logistics, drivers, healthcare, it's you're probably pretty much there or ahead of where you were last year. Other sectors, hospitality, most obviously, but actually some other parts of healthcare, given that electives ceased happening in the health service in the UK in the first lockdown, significantly behind. So very lumpy story, very regional story as well. City centres, because the lockdown's clearly suffering more. So industries, so companies that are serving central London having more challenges than companies that are serving business parks in the suburbs. But broadly, through the autumn, what we saw was a real kind of uptick in confidence across jobs postings, across what clients were telling us through our jobs outlook and through what we were seeing reported in billings by REC members. When we went into that second lockdown in the mid to late autumn, I think there was a lot of concern that would turn around, and it really hasn't. We've now seen the data from that point, and there's a flattening off, basically, of activity, and then it's picked up again. Now, we are, as you say, heading into the beginning of a new year. The winter is long, so we might still see more coronavirus-controlled control breaks on activity. I think the thing that's changed now is that recruiters know how to trade through these. We've learned. And so I think if there are more of those, there'll be more of a stay. And of course, we can see the finish line now with the vaccine. So as an industry, clearly turnover down on last year, but actually swift action and a robust labour market recovery. I think it's already showing that showing in the economist predictions that unemployment will peak lower than we might have thought previously. And I'm a bit more optimistic about 2021.
Yeah, optimism, I think, is a good way of capturing it. You know, especially with the vaccine now being distributed, then hopefully that gives confidence to employers that, you know, they can go ahead with their hiring plans, which in turn impacts us. You mentioned industry trends survey. Now, I know the REC is heavily involved in research. Is this something that is only for members, or can people listening get hold of that somehow?
So headlines will be available on the REC website. The full survey obviously goes to members. What's really interesting though is what we're doing in addition to that. And that'll be coming out in the next few weeks, actually. So do keep an eye on the REC website once you've listened to the podcast today. As well, we've kind of done the measurement of what the industry billed in its last financial year, and we've made some real progress in terms of thinking about the number of placements in that year and some flash data on the impact of the March to September period, which is in the report and which I've given you a flavour of already. The next stage is actually we're digging deeper. We're looking at the real impact of the industry on opportunity, on productivity for clients. And this goes to the heart of what I think is a big challenge for us all in recruitment, which is to make a value-based rather than a price-based argument for what we do. It's a human industry. It's a high-skill industry. We should be deeply embedded with clients, their trusted advisor. And you know, if you go and do into a merger or an acquisition as a client, you don't pay your lawyers on a contingency basis. And that's a challenge for all of us, because the value of what we do will become progressively more clear. And I actually think that the fundamentals of the UK labour market, in particular the tightness of labour supply, which will come back quite quickly as we recover, gives us an opportunity to reset our client relationships. That's something that the REC wants to work hard to support recruiters to do. And our upcoming report really shows the value that the industry delivers on productivity, diversity and inclusion. Some of these things that have a more imperceptible but clear impact on the prosperity of the country.
I'd love to dive into that further, because I agree 100% with what you're saying. And I love the idea of this being about delivering more value rather than it just being about price. Could you elaborate a bit on the value that the industry brings, rather, you know, apart from just obviously finding people for jobs? Like you mentioned, some of that value is not obvious on the surface.
Well, I think if you think of the industry as just matching, then it becomes very transactional. Mm-hmm. And two things. One, I think matching is already getting progressively more automated, and we'll see more competitors. And in fact, clients themselves, with a bit of investment, can start to do that kind of thing. I don't think they can necessarily do it as well as we can, but they can give it a go. I think the value is somewhere else. It's in how do you bring the right people into your business that support your culture, and then get them properly engaged with direction of travel, proper expectations. We know from REC work over years that the wrong hire can cost a client business hundreds of thousands of pounds to get right. In that picture, then you want to get it right. And if you think about advice on employer brand, you think about routes to market, you think about inclusion, and the really clear work, I think Bruce Daisley put this really well in his book, The Joy of Work. You know, how we belong, how we come into a group, and how we feel we know what the group is about, and how we set our goals is actually critical to our long-term performances as employees. Well, recruitment is hugely important to that. So all of that, plus the fact that, you know, your clients in TA and HR, they're seeing their world change around them as well, because business plans are changing, and they're thinking, well, how does my people plan fit into this new business that's being designed in the line? That creates a space for advice and for workforce planning and for employer brand and for employee value proposition and for diversity and inclusion thinking and all of the complexities of humans that a truly professional recruitment organization should want to be part of. So the delivery is part of it. It's always going to be part of it, but it is a genuine professional service. And I think you need deep client relationships. That's how you get to that value space. And it's also how we protect ourselves from commodification of the services we offer.
I'd like to circle back to that, because that's a real frustration for those who want to provide a value-added service that is a true professional service rather than just a transactional, commoditized, price-driven one. But before that, do you have any examples of, like, even anecdotally about our industry bringing value to employers above and beyond what they would be able to achieve themselves?
So I've got a really good story, and it will remain anonymous, but we've got a member who works with a poultry company. So pretty hard end of the labour market, this. So chicken factory. And in redesigning the work in the chicken factory, introducing new machinery, our member was able to work with them to redesign how the human beings did their part of the work. So moved from standing to sitting, redesigned the space with the feedback from some of the people that they'd placed, both pen, pad, and perm, ended up in a situation where they were actually designing better jobs for people to do, more productive jobs for people to do. So at no cost, what you were doing was you were increasing retention and you were improving the attraction of the work. One interesting thing is that they also improved the diversity. So the jobs, once they became seated and redesigned, so had a much better balance between men and women in the jobs than previously. So that kind of thinking about how does my HR planning fit into my business planning, my capital investment plan, and helping TA and HR people in clients think about it, that should be a critical role for the industry. And, you know, clients have a tendency of paying some consultant somewhere to think about these things. Those consultants are neither as expert nor as cost effective as we are as recruiters. So we need to get into that space.
Interesting. Interesting. I think you share an example with me previously on how there was empirical evidence that third-party recruiters were delivering better against diversity and inclusion than companies were able to achieve themselves. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it's part of our work that we're doing at the moment. A really clear story that if you randomly select someone from a Black or other minority ethnic background who's working and someone from a white background, the person from the Black or other minority ethnic background is much more likely to have found their job via an agency. And that speaks to, you know, the value of proper process, the value of thinking through how things happen. And, you know, one of the things we think the industry can be is a real agent for change. We talk at the REC about making great work happen. And we mean it. You know, we mean that the industry is an engine of growth for clients and opportunity for candidates. You know, people listening, that's why I did it when I started, and it's why lots of us do it still. And I think the more of that opportunity we deliver as an industry, the better our reputation will be, and the more effective we will be as companies, the more profitable we will be. So that purpose thing is really important to me. And I think we need to be proud of what we do as an industry. I think it's too easy to kind of to hide away from, you know, those who would incorrectly compare recruitment to other sectors. We change lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100%. In fact, I interviewed an entrepreneur and they have a target based on number of lives changed, rather than say, this is the number of placements we make. And they've done something like, you know, 10,000 lives changed or something they've achieved in the last, you know, 15 years, which I love that that thinking.
Yeah, and I think the important thing is it's not soft and fluffy. It's not uncommercial. It's absolutely commercial. Your commercial success is linked to how well aligned the goals of the people in the business are. And purpose is what helps you do that. You know, I certainly think we get more effective change and process progress from the REC team when purpose is clear. We've seen that this year. You know, the amount of innovation that we've done in our business in terms of delivering everything remotely and online, right up to and including formal off-call regulated examinations, has been stunning. And one of the things I often say is, you know, if you look back across the year, you wouldn't wish this year on anyone. But the REC of December, January 2020-21 is a better and fitter and more effective servant of the recruitment industry in the UK than the one in March. I love the one in March. It was great. This one is now better.
Yeah. Do you know what? That's probably the most significant upside to this whole thing is that it's forced innovation and it's forced us all to really get super creative and, you know, accelerate maybe plans that we had for the future and make them happen now. What, you know, just on that subject, what are you seeing your members doing to drive that innovation, change the way they're working in a way that is actually ultimately going to mean that they're more effective than they might otherwise have been?
So I think that one of the things that's come through most clearly, and I remember talking to Rona Driggs at Empresario about this at great length, and Rona's a great thinker on these things, is it's kind of two who's. Firstly, who's looking after your clients for you? Because we definitely had an experience when furlough happened and firms were furloughing consultants, that the client relationship was lost a bit, in as much as it was always between one person on the client side and perhaps a senior consultant or one of the directors on the agency side. And that sense of needing to put a team around the client so that the client contact remains robust has come through really, really clearly. And on the second one then is who is the client? Because I think in this world, go back to something I said earlier, I think that just the TA, the talent acquisition team, or just the HR team probably isn't enough, because the critical thing right now, and this is where I see a lot of innovation happening, is understanding where the business itself is going. So it's understanding the business plan and almost kind of conspiring with the talent acquisition and the HR team to design the people plan that gets you there. And some of that might not be stuff that you as an agency will deliver. It might come from elsewhere. But those two things seem to me important to those deep, productive relationships going forward, whether they end up in a kind of MSP arrangement or a PSL arrangement or whatever arrangement suits that particular client relationship. So I'm seeing people thinking about, you know, 360 has always been popular as an approach, seeing more chat about 180 coming back in terms of structuring how we deal with clients. And then obviously alongside that, you've got the whole question of rec tech. And what I'd say about technology is it's going to be necessary to remain competitive, to be able to automate the stuff that is automatable, so your consultants can be doing the things that consultants do best, the human stuff. But it's not sufficient to compete. I think just automating, you know, technology will not save us on its own. The most innovative firms I see have got a twin track. They're thinking about what consultants should do and redesigning consultants' work while also thinking about what the tech stack they need is for the business. So one of the things I'm thinking about at the REC is how we can better advise companies on acquiring new technology, because the challenge in the field is there are an awful lot of vendors out there and every vendor has a perfect product for you. And the great value of being a not-for-profit at the REC that's entirely funded by our members' subscriptions is there's only one group of people we answer to, and that's the members. And so anything that we do on that kind of thing is completely unbiased. And I'm thinking about that as part of a kind of a jacked-up business advice strategy for the REC going into next year.
Okay, interesting. Circling back to this issue of commoditization and the way that we're embedding with clients and the value of the work we're doing with them. What ideas have you got, Neil, to help? I mean, or what advice are you giving your members, I guess would be a better way of putting this, to help them to achieve that? Because sometimes there's certainly the willingness on the part of the recruitment agency. They want a deeper client relationship. They want multiple contact points within the client organization. They want to be that trusted advisor. But the client is not thinking along the same lines and wants to, even though it's, they don't necessarily realize it's working against their best interest, but they want to have more of a traditional approach, multi-agency, contingency, low fee, everything goes through a vendor management system. First person who chucks the CV into the system gets the fee. You don't know really which of these jobs is important, and you're not getting feedback. Therefore, when you talk to your candidate, you really have nothing to tell them about why or why not they've been selected, and so on. Like, that's kind of like the worst case, but that still happens a lot. What advice do you have for your members on how we can help our clients to move to a better relationship?
So probably the first thing to say is it's tough. It is really tough. Your point about VMS is I absolutely agree with. And it won't come quickly. Having said that, we've got two ears and one mouth, and it's usually best to use them in that ratio in client relations. Mm-hmm. It's about crafting the opportunities to have a different discussion. I've done a series of podcasts for the REC during this year, looking at different angles on the industry. And I've had quite a few with people on the client side who I trust implicitly. Jane Haynes at GSK, my ECAS Council colleague, Ruth Penfold from BP Launchpad. And what they said is what gets their time and their attention is something that feels a bit different, is an idea or a thought process. And of course, that's got to be driven by where their business is now. So our advice is, firstly, understand where is my client's problem and pain point? And that requires lots of the best people in the industry gave one bit of advice in April and May, which is use this as an opportunity to have a conversation with clients when you don't have anything on the table.
Yeah.
And then build to that and start to shape ideas and just try to carve a little idea space. And you have to do that at a certain level. It has to be done at a senior enough level where people have a bit of leeway. HR directors are often good for this. And then you can start to have a discussion about, okay, where's the business going? What's the problem? And where do we go from here? And then the wind is at your back a little bit, because we're learning already that high unemployment does not mean every job gets filled. We're already struggling with drivers, with people in warehousing, with people in the food chain, as we kind of lose some numbers of staff from the EU, as we know that the generation we're bringing into the labour market at the moment, those who were born between 2000 and 2010, is smaller than the one that we're seeing leave the labour market, those who were born between 55 and 65. There is a squeeze on available talent in the UK right now. There's then complexity about skills development and how you develop skills effectively. There are a whole slew of problems that HR directors have. And I think actually the firm with the sharp ideas, I've seen some great examples. One of our board members at the REC is working with smart meters. And he's got a centre where he's got people coming in, training up with them as smart meter installers, and then putting them straight into the field. So they're taking on the training function, which is absolutely fascinating as a model. But and that's not going to be right for everyone. It's right for his clients and the clients he's talked to. And I think that process of more senior client relationships built slowly is the only way to do this. And we probably do face a long period of dual running, the kind of first CV into the VMS contingency approaches with us for a while, but we have to transition from it over time, because the trouble with races to the bottom is eventually you win it and you're at the bottom.
Exactly. This is really interesting. I think differentiation is a topic I'm really passionate about. And, we can't just push all the blame onto the client. We need to think about, well, what can we do as an industry, or what can each of us do as individual recruiters or as business owners to rethink our service offering and make sure that it does match up with clients' problems, pain points, and where their business is going. And that you are adding unique value that your competitors may not be.
And not writing business that doesn't help you and moves the market south.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's a difficult and brave decision to make, but it's in the long run, it's the right one.
Yes. No. Absolutely. Not accepting business that's not.
But we believe in our product. We believe in our product. Yeah. You know, we shouldn't have to knock down the price, because for everything we've already talked about, we know it's valuable.
Yeah.
No, that's why government is looking to recruiters to advise on getting people back into work, because they, you know, DWP work coaches in the UK are very skilled at helping people who are a long way from the labour market understand the world of work. They're really not very good in helping people navigate recruitment processes.
Yeah. No, absolutely. You touched on this earlier, but I just wanted to return to it briefly. Is that the public perception of the recruitment industry, and what is the REC doing, and what do individual recruiters need to do in order to improve that?
So can I just be a bit provocative on this for a second?
Okay, go for it.
The people who think the public perception of the recruitment industry is lowest are people who work in the recruitment industry. When we look at our survey data, it's actually a lot better than we might think.
Okay.
And you know, our data is really positive about what clients think recruiters deliver. Mm. I think we are a bit bashful, and I think we've been quite operational as an industry, and I think more time spent driving at the things we can really change that are more strategic, talking about inclusion, talking about candidate experience. You know, this year's a real opportunity. You know, we're talking to each other now, and you've invited me into your home, and I've invited you into mine. There's a note of humanity to 2020.
Yeah,
that is helpful, and effective recruitment processes are, after all, human processes, and they require careful handling. This is a skilled role, a skilled job that is done by skilled professional services professionals. And we need to really commit to that.
Fantastic. I love that. So what else do we as an industry need to do, though, in order to ensure that we are relevant to clients' needs, you know, going forward? You touched on automation and how that will, over time, change a little bit what we do, but what should recruiters and recruitment business owners be doing now to really be prepared?
Well, we talk a lot at the REC about recruiters as jobs experts, work experts, and the world of work is changing an awful lot right now. And you know, I'm not a great fan of all of the hot takes that say the office is dead. I just genuinely don't believe that's true. We're social animals. I've got enough members of REC staff who would literally pay me to reopen the office right now, because they are desperate to get back there. Equally, I've got some members of staff who would happily not go back again. They're very happy working home. But we're fundamentally heading to a world of very individualized work arrangements. The example I often use is, if this new mixed model means people have to go to an office 2 days a week, maybe, or 3 days a week, well, if your job's in London, that means you could live in Plymouth, or you could live in Newcastle upon Tyne. And that means a lot of things for pay. It means a lot of things for negotiating packages. There's a complexity in all of this that we haven't seen before. And you know, skilled professionals have some advantage there. But I do think it is about understanding the dynamics of the labour market, the scope of supply in your specialist area. I think specialism always kills in this space, knowing the market. And then thinking about where the market's going next. I mean, it's difficult to say where Brexit ends up in terms of what it delivers in terms of the sectors which will be strong in the United Kingdom. But pretty clearly, we've seen that just this year, that if you are in certain IT fields, you haven't really had a recession. You know, IT, some fields in IT have been strong right through the year. So I think that strategic thinking about where the market's going and where the growth potential is really important. And it's why we're investing more in our research capacity in 21 to ramp up the support we offer recruiters in terms of thinking about, you know, where next, where are the growth areas. You know, I know one or two REC members who had a long discussion with in the autumn of 2019 about life sciences. They're feeling pretty good right now about their decision at the end of 2019, because the UK life sciences industry has been a game changer and is going to continue growing fast. So I think that that strategic view on the development of the labour market is really important.
Awesome. All right. What are you most proud of from your tenure thus far with the REC?
I'm most proud of how we've reacted to this, actually. I was going to say the kind of digitization and the rebrand and the tone of voice. Basically, I came in and tried to make the REC sound more like recruiters and you know, make us easier to deal with. And I think we did that. But in reality, in March, we faced two things. One, a massive increase in our workload. So we dealt with twice as many phone calls from members this year as last year. 12,000. So if I give you back to the the 3,300 members number I gave you at the top of the show, the average REC member has phoned our legal helpline four times this year.
Wow.
So that kind of scale of stuff, the hub, the coronavirus hub, the move of our helplines to a world where people were answering them from home rather than in the office, the move to online exams, and being just about the first sector association in the UK to run a fully digital conference, and keeping that really that conference really commercially focused. That work that I can't take credit for, it's been the REC team. That's probably what I'm proudest of in my time in the REC. Having said that, that new website and the tone of voice and the branding works really good. I think for the super long term, that was the right place to start. But the way the team have stepped up this year in terms of support of members, I think is absolutely right. And that's what you've got to do at the REC. You've got to go towards the sound of gunfire. So we ramped up in March and April just as the sector was falling away. We've done some work this autumn to retool ourselves for 21, because that's when we've had the time to think about it, and we've put a new management team in place to really drive things forward. And of course, I come back to the point, we are recruiters organizations. So, you know, we've had to look at things like making sure we don't charge members any more next year than we charged them this year, because it would be wrong to after a year like this. And we've been able to deliver that with some really careful planning by our team.
Right. Awesome. That's really cool, Neil. And I actually have found a lot of my clients, recruitment business owners, also have stepped up. I think everyone has sort of had to step up this year and work harder and do more, even maybe for the same or less, you know, money and resources than they had. But it has been a story about people, you know, working together or coming together in order to support each other. So,
I was speaking to a local recruiter in the deep southwest yesterday, one of our members, and she was telling me about how, you know, she has one big local competitor, and, you know, they used to be, shall we say, they used to fence off against each other quite a lot. And actually, they've developed quite a strong relationship through this year in terms of navigating through all of this. I've seen that right up to the biggest firms in the sector this year, where, you know, if you go back 5, 10, 15 years, if we got together in a room, everyone had always had the best quarter ever.
Yeah.
And actually now, you know, I found in the spring, when we were bringing government ministers in to meet groups of 15, 20 really senior people in the industry to talk about how you make furlough work for people who aren't employees, That we had a much more on the level conversation, very kind of engaged and very focused on the interests of all of us and not just one of us. And that maturity, I think, will serve the industry well for years to come. And I think it's picked up in exactly what you're saying in terms of the way leaders across the industry have stepped up this year.
Mm. You know, while we're on the subject, the theme of the show is resilience, and I think the industry has shown great resilience and during this year. But for you personally, Neil, what would you say has been one of your biggest challenges, let's say?
You know, we talk a lot about working from home, and my experience in the spring was not that. It was living at work. I know many, particularly owner-operators of recruitment businesses, have felt the same. You know, I think I've had about 4 days off since March the 12th. But the purpose is strong and we've pushed on through. But I think the thing that I've learned, and I think it's been reflected back at me by lots of people, is, you know, we all have a fuel tank. And we need to remember that sometimes it's pretty close to empty. So I think making sure that you're taking time for self-care, even when it feels like there's 101 urgent things. I worked with someone years ago who used to constantly remind me of the question, is it urgent or is it important?
Mm-hmm.
And getting a sense of what's important to where we want to be, not tomorrow, but in 6 months or a year's time, I think is particularly helpful. I've taken up running again after, I have to admit, just do the numbers, 13 years old off. I found that massively helpful. Making sure that we're carving out thinking time, actively throwing stuff off the back of the lorry that doesn't need to be on the lorry so we can focus on the things that really matter. And I think increasingly as business leaders, focusing on our human relations as well, because we're not seeing people every day. All those things are boosts to resilience. We are, after all, human beings, and kindness is the first thing we should start with. And that means, and kindness to ourselves as well as kindness to each other.
Yes, I love that. Thanks for sharing that. It's a value that many recruitment companies do not, like when you're coming up with their company values, I don't know any that use kindness as one of their corporate values, but I think it should be.
So I've got a kind of values. I struggle with values. And what I mean by that is I think values are personal. I think what we expect in companies is behaviors. Mm-hmm. And what I have seen across the industry in terms of thinking about how we change is lots of, one of our REC council members said this to me in the summer, is lots of decisions being made about the behaviours we want in our business.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw firms thinking about the pattern of furlough so that you didn't have people in the office burning themselves out while other people were getting progressively frustrated at home, and you were managing that so everyone had some purpose but were not overstretched, where you had restructurings taking place and people were asking the question, well, what sort of business do we want to be? You know, at the REC, we talk a lot about collaboration, openness, ownership, learning and enjoyment as the things we want to deliver. You know, that should be our experience of each other as REC staff, but it's also the relationship that we want to have with members. And that's helped us an awful lot. Even starting, we've started to use that framework in our reviews. So obviously people have, as you would always have to have, pretty tough targets in what we ask them to do. But we're also asking them to think about how they do it. And that's about, in a hard-nosed commercial sense, that's actually about the productivity the business generates, getting everyone faced in the same direction. And a kind of an unlooked bit for benefit of it is, of course, that most of the objectives that we set for REC staff back in January have been somewhat overtaken by events. But But the behavioral stuff is just as relevant now as it was then.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, from what you're describing, I would argue that the values and the behaviors really work together, right, in that context. Let me go back to your running. We have a lot of runners who follow, who subscribe to the show and listen to it when they're going. So chances are there's people right now.
If you want to feel good about your pacing, follow me on Strava. You're definitely quicker than me.
I will do that, Neil, because I'm on Strava. But I think, yeah, I'm not running fast by any means, but I'm quite proud of myself because when this 12 months ago, I wasn't even ever a runner, but I could barely run a kilometer. And just the other day I did 15K and
amazing.
That's just been a steady progression over the last 12 months.
Whoop. Yeah, I'm trying to do 5K 3 times a week and mostly succeeding. It's more difficult this time of year, obviously, because running in the dark.
Yeah.
Having said that, my story as a runner is I ran my last half marathon on about the 25th of April 2007. And then my daughter was born on the 8th of May. And I hadn't run since then. I did a bit of cycling, but I hadn't really run since then. And I play rugby still. Play and coach rugby. Getting back to it has been really helpful. It's been really therapeutic. And you kind of learn that the value of it is what's happening in your head as well as what's happening in your legs.
Absolutely. No, for sure. Do you mind if I ask you, Neil, you'd mentioned to me previously about imposter syndrome. Can you speak a little on that?
Yeah, I think it's quite powerful for leaders to be really open and honest about how they feel. And, you know, I can come off as quite white male Oxbridge. And the reason for that is I am white, I am male, and I am Oxbridge. But I'm also working class and comprehensive school educated and not very comfortable with kind of high society or whatever you want to call it, which I think a lot of people in the recruitment industry are, because you know we're self-made men and women often. And the reason that I like to talk about this is the number of times during my career where I felt everyone else has a map in their back pocket and I don't. Mm. And I've realized over time that what they don't, what they have is actually sky high confidence that in some way, in some form has come to them in the past. And it's more about realizing everyone is busking and doing their best and feeling comfortable with that and doing the hard work to get you where you need to go. And, you know, for me, one of the things I'm proudest of in my career is I work on a Royal Pay Commission, which gives 1.5 million people a pay rise every year. And that piece around economic inclusion across different diversity strands, but actually, you know, I think socioeconomic mobility really matters, and it matters more than ever now, because if you look at the labour market data, actually prime age people in the workplace are doing okay. When you start to look at the unemployment numbers for young people, they are absolutely horrific. So there's a real kind of injunction on us all to do something about that. And it's partially about us opening up opportunity, but it's also about encouraging people to believe that they can do things. Because I don't think 16 or 18 year old me would have believed I could have done what I do now. And I think many of us in the industry would feel that way. That classic phrase of "I fell into recruitment," which we all did, including me. I'd like to change that over time, but equally, recruitment has given us a pathway to show what we can do, and that sense of everyone's busking it. It's actually about how you put your mind to achieving something and the networks you build and the help you ask for and the openness about your mistakes. You know, I think for years I was, because it all felt fragile, I was terrified that one mistake would see me kind of fall off the cliff. And that's not true. And, you know, if you come from a different background, maybe you know that. I certainly didn't. So a lot of what I do around the edges of my career, it is really about trying to encourage young people, particularly young people from less advantaged backgrounds, to feel that they can do things. And one of the things we can all do, and I think particularly in our industry where so many of us didn't go to public school or have a trust fund, because actually recruitment is a massively meritocratic industry.
I think
the more those of us who have leadership positions talk about our self-doubt, which, to be fair, just for me to be absolutely clear, I think self-doubt is a sign of intelligence and ability to lead. I think the better for all of us.
Hear, hear. Well said, well said. So if people want to find out more about the REC and the work you're doing, it's rec.uk.com. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Fantastic. And when they visit the website, I mean, there's a lot on there. Is there something in particular you want people to search up or to get involved in, you know, as if they're new to the REC?
So I think a couple of things. We're doing some work at the moment around diversity and inclusion, which we've people, this might cause a few ears to prick up. We're doing jointly with APSCO because it's so important to our industry. So if, when you read this, you want to have a look at that, that would be really interesting. We're looking for details and feedback, but really do have a look at the work that we're doing on the economic and social value of the industry, because what we want to do is tell stories about the difference we make, not just come up with big numbers. So progressively through December and January, we'll see new bits of work start to appear that really tell a different story about the industry, and engaging with us, helping us, whether it's video, social media, written examples, we are looking for new ways to tell the human story of the industry, to really get to the bottom of the difference we make, because it's enormous. And I think we have a lot more to be proud of than maybe sometimes we allow ourselves to believe.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Neil Carberry. And I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks, Mark. It's been a pleasure.